Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
We all live in a reality tunnel, but your reality tunnel is not reality. It's what you think reality is. Okay. It's just a model. But being a model, it's smaller and not 100% accurate, and there are places where it doesn't quite match the thing it's supposed to represent.
Hello, welcome to the Clown Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is a trip of a conversation. It just is. I ran into this guy, John Higgs's work. He's a British journalist. It got recommended to me on a podcast, which I mentioned in here. And I got turned on to a book of his called KLF, Chaos, Magic, Music, Money. And it blew my mind a bit. It was just one of the strangest and most intellectually interesting books I've read in this year, I don't know. And then I kind of began working my way through Higgs's work. I read his biography of Timothy Leary. I have America Surrounded, Stranger Than We Can Imagine, his History of the 20th Century. And he's just a brilliant, strange thinker. And this is a weird tour through the things he thinks about. But you will see very much why it has spoken to me so much. It is just right on the mission of this podcast. This is one of those conversations I don't know how to describe, so I will not try, but it is worth your time. And if you remain open to it, there's a lot of great frames for thinking about the world, and at least frames worth thinking about as you move through the world. As always, my email, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is John Higgs. John Higgs, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ezra.
Here's my first question for you. Like, who the hell are you? What are you doing?
Well, I'm a writer in Britain, and I write a lot of books about the history of ideas, really. Not a huge amount of them have been
that
published over
That is definitely
in
not what you are writing.
Is that not? What am I writing? What have you read?
I started with a KLF book, which blew my mind, and then I read your Leary biography. And then I read Stranger Than We Can Imagine.
Yes.
So that's been, I've read the recent trilogy, but it is very clear to me that you are working on a unified project that is not a history of ideas.
I'm definitely working on a unified project, absolutely. But the sense of it being about how ideas shape the world we live in is getting more and more central to it. It's becoming, you know, absolutely key. There's this notion that, you know, ideas create culture and culture creates values and values create actions and actions create history. And so if you're not including, you know, the immaterial in your view of the world, then you're missing something very important.
Yeah, that is fair. But tell me a bit about what unites these three books. What do you see as the message of them, more specifically than ideas matter? Because something about reading them is a little psychedelic itself.
Yeah.
It's a very perspective shifting kind of intellectual history you're doing. And I'm curious where it came from.
Well, it's where it came from. Okay, there's many, many routes into that question. There's this Soviet notion, the engineers of the soul, that writers and artists and musicians are the engineers of the soul. And it seems to me that the creative community of which I'm part of has sort of been failing very, very strongly to give people a sense of the world that is worthy of them, that's any good. The amount of people who are just angry and convinced that everyone else is wrong, and just desperately trying to understand why they're the only one who sort of doesn't get it and everyone else are just, you know, are just wrong. It just runs through our culture so, so thickly. And I think if you want to view my work as a project, it's a way to sort of dismantle a lot of the flaws that have gone into that sort of worldview.
So can I tell you what I've been taking away from it?
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell me how you came to it, actually, Ezra?
I was listening to a podcast with Yancey Strickler, who's the Intellectual Explorers Club. And he mentioned, and Strickler, he is the founder of Kickstarter, mm-hmm. And he writes a great newsletter, and he sort of became differently famous recently for this idea of the dark force theory of the internet. Fascinating guy. People should look him up. He's about to publish a book, too. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he mentioned your book offhandedly, and the way he explained it, your book on the KLF, which we will get into, so I apologize to the audience if this is starting a little bit confusingly, but believe me, this is all going to be confusing. And the way he explained it, this idea of the idea space and the ways in which ideas become real and develop a life of their own and begin to influence us beyond our own agency was fascinating to me. So I cracked open that book. It was unlike anything I've read in quite some time, which mm-hmm. was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to the Leary biography, which seemed to be its roots. And I've read a couple biographies of Leary, and I thought yours was by far the best. And then I went to the more recent one. But before we get into all of them, and we will, the thing that you seem to me to be doing is finding different ways to explore the idea that in the 20th century, our ability to rely on the idea of a concrete external reality that other people would be perceiving in roughly the way we are perceiving it, crumbled. Mm. And that we have not been willing to admit that this happened. And in not being willing to admit that this happened, we have ended up in a very confusing and chaotic place. And you seem to be exploring different stories that make clear this happened.
Very much so, yeah. Especially that book about the 20th century, Stranger Than We Can Imagine. That's the main sort of theme that runs through it. I've also done a more recent book called The Future Starts Here that looks at the where we are now at the 21st century. And so much of it seems to be, the last thrash of the dragon's tail, really. That sort of concrete, individualistic sort of single reality. People who grew up with that idea just lashing out and trying to make sense of where we are now. It's a really key core idea, I think, that once you've got it, unlocks so many other things.
So I'm American. I'd never heard of the KLF before. Mm. I think probably most of my audience is not. Who are the KLF? What did they do? Why did you decide to write about them?
Well, mainly because most people have never heard of them, even though the fact that they were in around 1991, you know, the biggest selling singles band in the world. They had awards, they had, you know, critical acclaim, and they just decided to step back. And they, being independent, they were able to delete all their records, at least in the UK, at least. So they no longer appear on, you know, film soundtracks or adverts or anything like that. And they sort of attempted to sort of remove themselves from musical history. And they almost did. They almost got away with it, except they still had the money. They still had the money they made. They had about £1 million. And for reasons that they were never able to explain, they just took that money and they got on a small plane and they flew to the Isle of Jura in the Scottish Hebrides. And just after midnight on the 23rd of August, 1994, they went into this sort of a abandoned boathouse by the edge of this island. And they just opened the suitcase and they took the money out and they set fire to it. And they just set fire to the whole £1 million. And it's one thing to start burning £1 million. It's quite another to actually finish. You know, it took an hour or so to sort of burn all this. And we're never able to explain why. And this just sort of stuck in my craw. It was an act that wasn't contained in my philosophy. I had no way of framing it. I had no way of sort of understanding it. And I think we have a natural bias to, when we come across something that just doesn't fit how we understand the world, to just ignore it and just to move on. And which is what most people did. I mean, I wrote my book about 17 years afterwards, but that's because it had been bugging me. It had been bugging me for 17 years. And I wanted to try and find a philosophy that would sort of contain this act. And I knew just doing a regular music biography wasn't going to work, because many journalists have interviewed them and asked them about it, and no one's got any closer, no one's got any wiser. So it seemed important to take a step back and try and understand the culture around them, the ideas that were influencing them. And so, although, you know, I say the book is about this 1990s dance band, the KLF, really it's about Alan Moore, and it's about Robert Anton Wilson, and it's about Doctor Who. It's about idea space. It's about magic. It's about
we're going to go through all these things. I have I have a long list, but I want to note something that you just said. There's a line I've thought about for years now, and I don't remember the name of the guy who said it, but an investor said that all great investments begin with the three words, huh, that's weird.
Yeah.
And I always thought that's true about a lot of journalism too, a lot of thinking, a lot of science, that there is a difference between looking at the world and seeing something that doesn't make sense and just moving on from it.
Yeah.
And looking at the world and seeing something that doesn't make sense and digging into it. Because the other thing, I think it was the same guy who said, was that the world always makes sense. It's you that doesn't understand it. It's never the world doesn't make sense. Like, if it's not making sense, your model is the one here that is flawed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't want that. We don't, I talk a lot about in that book about the concept of reality tunnels, which does come from Timothy Leary, and Robert Anton Wilson was probably the best writer on the subject.
Can you just say who Robert Anton Wilson is? I think people probably know Timothy Leary, sort of father of the psychedelic revolution, but Robert Anton Wilson is a more obscure figure.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a friend of Timothy Leary. He was a writer in that 1970s psychedelic counterculture world of, you know, conspiracies and drugs and all these things that will probably make people go, oh, well, that's, you know, there's no credibility at all there. But to my mind, he's one of the very few people who sort of lived through the 20th century and understood it and moved through it, rather than sort of reaching a point where you become horrified and you reject things and you start to try and go back to, like, you know, before postmodernism or whatever. Robert Anton Wilson, for me, was one of the few people who understood the 20th century.
So you said something about the KLF here that I want to go back to. Mm. You said that they burnt all this money.
Yeah.
And they could never explain why they did it. And that's an easy line to skip over, but it's actually central to the book. Because I think that if you had just told me that a rock band burnt £1 million, I would have said, oh, because they're huge assholes.
Yeah. That was
like, what an irresponsible thing to do. You can give that money away. You can save children. You can, you know, I mean, 1991, you probably won't be fighting global warming, but there's a lot you can do with £1 million, particularly £1 million in 1991. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah. That was very much the common reaction.
So when you say they could not explain why they did it, what do you mean beyond, like, these assholes didn't explain why they did it?
I do discuss the notion in the book that they're just a pair of attention-seeking assholes.
You did,
but
yes.
There's a lot.
It is a hypothesis that is considered.
There is a lot in the musical world who fit that description, you know, and they generally don't go around burning £1 million. It's not enough. It's not enough of an explanation in itself. I think we can take it for read that it's fair that a high proportion of people would consider them a pair of, you know, arseholes for doing this. But we've all met arseholes, and they don't do anything as shocking or interesting or horrifying or wrong or, you know, just mind-blowing as this, really.
And so they went on a tour asking people why they burnt £1 million.
Oh, yeah. A film showing. Yes,
that's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's fair to say they were in the midst of a bit of a breakdown at that point.
Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. This was the year after. They went with a guy called Gimpo, who was their roadie, and one journalist just to observe it. And he had one of those small early video cameras. So he just sort of stood there and, with a slightly shaking hand, just filmed the whole thing. And so they had this footage of it. And it's quite strange, the effect it has on people. You know, I've done events where there has been a money burner doing money burning in public. Because there's quite a scene of it now. There's quite this money burning scene. And it's seen as an act of sacrifice, as an act of forgiveness with no hope of getting anything in return. The idea is that all cultures sacrifice figures somewhere. But, you know, normally if you sacrifice a goat, you know, to something beyond you, that's fine, but it's not really fair on the goat. Burning money is the only form of sacrifice where you're also the victim. It's seen in spiritual circles as the most ethical form of sacrifice is to burn your own money, as weird as all this is. And so I've been in rooms where people have set fire to money, and the effect on people is just extraordinary. There's always someone who'll shout out, "What about Syria?" or just some random sort of nonsensical sort of things like that. It horrifies people. It's so wrong by every sort of cultural understanding that they have. It's just shocking. It's just the atmosphere just turns cold. It's very weird.
There's an interesting thing about the "What about Syria?" right? And I want to say, as somebody who like identifies as an effective altruist, I think "What about Syria?" is the correct question.
Yeah.
But it is not one we would ask if rock stars spent $1 million, or I'm sorry, £1 million on hookers and blow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, on cars.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If they just bought a really nice house, like just a really nice house that was on a cliff somewhere, and it just burnt a ton of energy to be there, and it was totally extravagant, and so it's clearly a net negative for the world, like there would be no chorus of condemnation. And so I just want to note that while I think the "What about Syria?" is correct, and like many of us use money in a fundamentally immoral way, it is an attack we apply to rationalize a sense of offense. It is not something we, most of us, but there are effective altruists who do, apply with enough rigor to make it clear that that is really what we are feeling here.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's nothing to say that these people doing that haven't also been donating, you know, money to the homeless or to Syria or you know, or whatever. In fact, they generally tend to be more likely to have given money to charity in the recent past than people who are shocked by what they're doing. I think they're thinking about it. I think they're thinking about what money is and what it sort of means to them. And you know, if you do feel that you have contributed what you can to sort of help people, and you have 20 quid left and you could go and spend it at the bar, or you could sort of do what they view as a sort of a spiritual ritual, it's very different than just a dumb rock star, just no sense of the value of money.
But you're using them in the book as what we call, like journalists, what they call a mule, right? A mule to carry your story.
Right, yes.
To explore a bunch of very unusual ideas. And why don't we start with this one? What is Alan Moore's concept of the idea space?
Yeah, Alan Moore. I mean, I presume you're familiar with, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Alan Moore.
But audience may not be, so give a quick capsule of Alan Moore.
He is the guy who wrote Watchmen and V for Vendetta. He was one of the key comic writers in the 1980s who sort of changed the medium beyond recognition, to create the sort of sense that comics could be art, really, could be literate, could be important, could be worthy. He's probably the single most lauded comic writer alive, but he's also known as the one who's most rejected the Marvel DC superhero world, the one who's stood away from it as much as he possibly can. He's very critical of the fact that, you know, in the 21st century, adults are going to see films about superhero stories that were written to entertain 8-year-olds in the 1960s. You know, he feels we should have progressed beyond that sort of point quite a lot. He's a fascinating man. He's an absolutely fascinating man. And he talks a lot about magic. And by magic, he defines it in a way that most people would probably not be expecting. He defines it as almost the same as art, really. He describes it as something that occurs in the mind, you know, where else would it be? And he uses magic as a way to understand the effect that art and creativity and imagination has on people and then on the wider world. He looks terrifying. He looks like an angry working class Gandalf. He's got this sort of huge beard and loads of rings on every hand. He's an absolutely lovely
fan. It is worth Googling Alan Moore. And actually, you can find on YouTube, you and Alan Moore in conversation. It's worth reading
Alan Moore. You know, for my money, he is the greatest living English writer. Well, I say that without a doubt. The stuff that he's done is just extraordinary. And if people are just considering reading Alan Moore. I would just push them wholeheartedly. Just try anything. You know.
Where do you start? What is your if you're considering one Alan Moore work? Where do you start?
Oh, I mean, Watchmen would probably be the an interesting bet. From Hell, I think would also.
I think Watchmen.
One.
You need to know too much about comics to know.
Maybe right. Because I'm not a fan of comics or superheroes. So, its historical importance. So many people have, you know, desperately tried to rip it off. So a lot of what was brand new about it may not seem quite so brand new now, thanks to all the sort of copy and sort of things. So, let's say From Hell. Go and read From Hell.
From Hell is
his account of the Jack the Ripper saga.
But okay, so his definition of magic.
Yes. He and his friend, the late Steve Moore, thought a lot about this notion you mentioned, idea space. And it sort of came from, you know, when he was still going out in public and doing conferences, and people would ask him, you know, where do your ideas come from? And, you know, and all artists get that question, and they all have some, you know, they brush it off sort of thing. But he was of the opinion that this was actually a really good question. You know, if you're a taxi driver, you understand how the car works, how your engine works. You know, if you're a writer, you should understand how your imagination works. But he couldn't find any models of this, any definitions. And so he started to explore this notion of idea space, which assumes that ideas are real things, real in a different way to, you know, physical things that we have about it. But, you know, the idea of a unicorn is still a real idea of a unicorn. The way that the mind works, we use a lot of spatial metaphors, things like the front of your mind, or it's on the tip of your tongue, or all these sort of things. Although they're connected in different ways than the real world. So in Britain, we often talk about Land's End to John O'Groats, which is the southernmost part of Cornwall at the south, and the most northernmost part of the Scotland. So it's the longest part of distance between two places in Britain. And so they're in reality, in the material world, they're utterly separate. But because we always link them together in idea space, they're sort of close and similar to each other's. And the idea of, I don't know, Madonna or, you know, Hillary Clinton or someone that everybody knows is kind of a shared thing. But we all have our own secret little corners of idea space of things that are just only known to us. There's some fascinating interviews where he talks about these notions and sort of how these things work, which explains a lot of his drive and his sort of work. But the idea that once there's an idea out in idea space, then, you know, lots of people sort of stumble upon it at any one time. The idea of the role of the artist is to sort of go deeper than most people and explore further and go out into the wilderness and come back with rarer and more interesting ideas that other people haven't gotten, to bring them and share them out to most people. So idea space is sort of a conceptual model for the work of the mind on many ways. Is this making any sense?
It is, but I think it's important to get at this. There's a banal version of this.
Mm-hmm.
And a very radical version of this.
Mm-hmm.
So on one level, the idea space that there is like a conceptual way of thinking, there's a space in which ideas connect to each other. It's like, of course, mm-hmm. right? That's, you could just call that culture.
Yeah.
He is talking about something different, or at least believes in something somewhat different. You are using it in a slightly different way. So talk about where the idea space goes from banal to radical, where it becomes a space that is perhaps not controlled by us. I mean, you say this yourself in the book, that Alan Moore, the place you say, and I'm quoting this a little bit from memory, but I looked at it the other day, that the place where Moore takes us into a controversial territory is the idea that these ideas can in some ways operate us.
Yes.
That I think the way you are describing the idea space is a space we have agency over. Okay, I believe in a connection between Madonna and Hillary Clinton, and certainly there are parts of the idea space that I possess. And, you know, like, and expand my idea space by talking to you. But you're talking about me as somebody exploring a world of ideas, which I think is a very, very common concept. The way you describe this in the KLF is as a world of ideas acting upon us.
Yeah, I get you. Well, the notion is that in the physical world, when something becomes sufficiently complicated, it becomes alive. Be that, you know, an insect or a person or whatever. Once it's sufficiently set up, it has its own actions, it has its own agency, it sort of goes off by itself. The idea was whether that also applied in idea space as well, whether an idea could become sufficiently sophisticated to act for all intents and purposes like a living thing. Because when an idea acts like a living thing, it's very hard to define whether that counts as a living. The difference between a thing that acts as a living thing and a thing that is a living thing, very, very hard to define. talk a lot about these ideas that seem.
You use Doctor Who as the example of this.
Yeah, well, it's one of the most sophisticated, detailed, complicated sort of British myths that we have in this country, because it's been going since, you know, 1963, and we all sort of grow up watching it, and it used to be there'd be a big cliffhanger at the end, and you'd be waiting the next week to work out, you know, how the doctor survived in the school round. You'd all be talking about it, and you'd be imagining it. You'd be trying to work out, you know, how ways he would have survived. You'd be essentially trying to write the next sort of episode in your head. And all the kids grow up doing that, then became, or a certain percentage of them became, writers because they wanted to write Doctor Who. So now Doctor Who is creating the very thing that it needs to keep going indefinitely, which is people who desperately sort of want to write Doctor Who. And on many different levels that I talk about in the book, it just acts like a living thing. It sort of grows, it sort of evolves, it sort of changes, it has a history, you know, any way you want to define it, eats people up, you know, the people who've been burnt out sort of using it. It's any way you want to define a living thing. It's very hard not to include the concept of Doctor Who in that at the same time, apart from the fact that it's not material, the fact that it's just purely idea space, you know, or the noosphere, which is a phrase I use in later books.
What is a noosphere?
It comes from a Jesuit priest in the 1920s, I think, whose name's escaping me. But the essential idea, there's at the base of our world, we've got the geosphere, which is the world of, you know, rocks and minerals, and above that we get biosphere, the world of ants, plants and animals and stuff. And the biosphere sort of grows out of the geosphere, and it moves quicker, and it's more sort of fluid, and it's more sort of it's less sort of solid. But out of the biosphere also arises the noosphere, which is the world of the immaterial, the world of ideas, the world of languages, laws, you know, culture, art, all these sort of things. And again, it's much more sort of fluid than the biosphere it sort of grows out of. It's these levels of increasing ethereal stuff that we have on the noosphere is basically the world of ideas.
We'll be right back with John Higgs.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. Have you ever tried mint chutney? It's a pretty nice sauce. Goes great with lamb. Well, Mint Mobile has got its own secret sauce. Sure, there's less cumin in it, and it doesn't go great with food, but it does go great with your phone bill. Their secret sauce is that they sell premium wireless service totally online. They've done away with the cost of retail, and according to them, it lets them pass all those savings on to you. It's why Mint's plans start at just $15 a month. By switching to Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. We all hate that. You can also get unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data from any of their plans. Signing up is convenient and painless. Now that sounds like a great sauce. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, you can go to mintmobile.com/grayarea. That's mintmobile.com/grayarea. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/grayarea. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been Podcast Futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
So to now connect the conversations we've been having and go into the connective tissue of the book, you make the case in the book that the KLF ends up burning this money and they can't describe or explain even to themselves very much why they did it. And you make the case that the idea space is operating on them, that there's a bunch happening in the culture around money at that moment that ends up somehow taking a hold of them in ways that are almost occult. But makes sense as you talk about them. So can you just talk a bit about how that grounds into that KLF story?
Yeah, I mean a lot comes to the nature of the two guys who were the KLF. It was Jimmy Courte and Bill Drummond. And I probably sort of unfairly on poor Jimmy Courte, I probably talk more about Bill Drummond in the book because he's the one who's most open about his creative process, which is an idea will just sort of appear. And bubble up inside himself. And at the point where most people would have their, you know, their cynical or their rational voice would come in and say, that's a terrible idea. What the hell? Just, you know, that's never going to work. Just kill it for good. He doesn't do that. He sort of lets it sort of go and evolve and grow naturally and see what it sort of becomes. So lots of really strange and terrible ideas that nobody else can understand. He will be sort of faithful to. He will allow them to sort of grow and become what they sort of need to be. So in normal circumstances, if people said, what should we do with this money? And the idea of burning it sort of came up. Most people would then immediately sort of scratch that one off the list, but not Bill. And in this case, not Jimmy. They just sort of thought about it. Or what does this idea mean? What does it want to be? How does it impact on us? What attracts us to it? And you know, all this sort of things. And they do a lot of strange things. They do a lot. There's a big music industry awards show over here called the Brit Awards. And in 1992, I think it was, they'd won the best band and they were supposed to open it and things like this. And they were horrified at this because they had real issues with the nature of the music industry. And really, they thought they were supposed to be attacking it and things like that. And the idea came to him that he should chop off his hand in the performance and throw it out into the audience. And again, most people wouldn't explore that idea to the level that he did. And they'd had a few years of just insane success.
How far did he explore that idea?
It was discussed. It was discussed seriously. They always talked about the one performance they wanted to do was just be to turn up on stage and open a box and have two antique dueling pistols and then just shoot each other. That was their dream show. This is why they split up. It was around this time. It was around the time when he was seriously thinking about chopping off his hand that they realised that they were perhaps not good for each other and that splitting up and ending the band and getting out was probably the wisest move. God, the stories of that band are just mad. They're just crazy. Constantly throughout the whole thing. And the odd thing was they had this reputation as being clever media manipulators who would do all these sort of scams to get attention and press. And it was so wrong, that idea. They really had no idea what they were doing. They were just sort of following impulses and seeing what was happening. And then something, you know, extraordinary and odd or just whatever happened and that sort of became the story. And retroactively it was said that, oh yeah, they planned that all along, but that was really not how they worked in the slightest.
To go back to that story about the awards show, it's actually influenced me in a certain way. You have a great paragraph about that. So what they ultimately do, and this has a particularly grim resonance in America right now, but what they ultimately do is they fire a machine gun filled with blanks into the audience of record executives. And that is this kind of this very, very intense form of protest, let's put it that way. Pulling it out of the American context of mass shootings for a minute, what happens then is that a bunch of record executives say, that was just a great performance. We loved it. And you describe this as a sort of trauma on the band that you have this kind of idea from the situationist that to oppose a spectacle is to become part of the spectacle. And I actually ended up quoting this recently. I don't know how much you know about me, but I'm a political journalist when I'm not talking to peculiar British writers. And I wrote about this in a big piece I was doing about the media and Donald Trump, wherein the problem the KLF ran into was that they were trying to critique the record industry, but the record industry was completely able to absorb that critique. You have this other great line that to piss on the altar of the church is still to pay homage to the church, and that we often have that issue in our coverage, particularly of Donald Trump, where he will do something terrible. We will try to say and generate all this energy about how terrible it is, but we are like that energy is part of his spectacle. It's part of his spectacle of conflict with the media, part of his spectacle of conflictual politics. And so we've become part of his show, even as what we're trying to do is show how corrupt and grotesque and racist and bigoted and so on the show has become. And like that's a very hard space to be in, to recognize that like you are part of the idea, you're not in control of the idea.
Very, very much so. Yeah. I mean, which is why they did what they did, which is to get out of the industry and destroy everything and delete the records and then ultimately burn the money. But that's not a position, you know, that doesn't work for political journalism.
Yeah.
Just burn down the newspapers. That'll show him.
but it's an interesting thing. I mean, something you talk about in the book a lot is this idea of being many modeled, and that oftentimes you'll find yourself doing something and it keeps not working. And when it keeps not working, there's a tendency to just get angrier and angrier at the world, as opposed to recognizing that your model is missing something, that you've begun looking at the world in a way that doesn't make sense any longer, that is obscuring something. And I mean, that's a theme in a number of your books, not mistaking your own model of the world for the world itself.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, in my last book about the 21st century, which is a lot about Generation Z and the move from the postmodern world to the metamodern world and all that sort of stuff, we've basically reached a point culturally where the sort of the edge of where we are is that, you know, all models are flawed, but some are useful. And that's the generally sort of, you know, that's where we are as a culture. All models are flawed and some are useful. But it's a lot of people sort of behind the curve at that. And there's still a lot of people who, the people have psychological need, you know, to be right, who assure that their model is the one great true model and that everyone else is wrong. And you'll never meet anyone who agrees with you 100% about everything, right? There's 6 billion people in the world. They all see things differently, have different sort of experiences, different backgrounds, different privileges. They all have a different take. And the idea that, hey, actually, you've got the one that's actually true and everyone's all wrong. You don't have to know not much math to realize that really it's not a very convincing idea at all, you know. And there is a real sort of fight against recognizing that from particularly the baby boomer generation, who sort of grew up before the postmodern period, who sort of grew up in the belief that there was an absolute truth, and you know, if you didn't have the absolute truth, then you were therefore wrong, and hence an enemy, and you know, must be fought. So even you get, I don't know, thinkers as different as like Jordan Peterson or Steven Pinker or sort of academically minded sort of people of that sort of generation, they still have this belief that, oh, postmodernism was when everything went wrong, so we need to go back to where we were before that sort of time and then everything will be fine, which is very different to the Robert Anton Wilson, who sort of powered through it and sort of managed to sort of come out of the of the other side.
One, dedicated listeners of the show are going to have just understood in that answer why your work appeals to me so much. This idea that the place we're in is all models are wrong, or I'm sorry, all models are flawed, but some of them are useful is very much, I think, the project of this particular show. I've been tracking recently this idea of the metamoderns. This is something that is burbling around kind of the edges of some of the spheres I track. Can you tell me what the term metamodern means?
Sure. Well, I mean, the simplest definition would be it's the thing that came after, you know, postmodernism. We all accept that the last part of the 20th century was generally known by this concept of postmodernism. There's this general sense that we've moved beyond it now. We see the flaws in it. We've sort of moved beyond it. And it's a lot of people are trying to define where we are. And this notion of metamodernism is the thing that seems to be bubbling up and seems to be gaining ground. And it tends to be defined slightly different from artists to, you know, academics. But there's a general sense it's about swings between, it's about extremes rather than the center point. It's not about, finding the best of both worlds. It's not about finding the neat compromise. It's about going to both extremes to find what's useful in those things. And for those of us raised in the 20th century, this can be quite scary. I mean, you can certainly see it with Brexit and Trump and the political situations in both our countries, that these sort of wild swings to the extremes are, for me and many people in my generation, quite scary and worrying and all that sort of thing. So the Generation Z, that's just normal. They're just sort of growing up with this sort of thing. And you can see this real sort of difference. But a big part of this is the huge shift between the millennials and Generation Z, the change in attitudes between those two generations is far more profound and extreme than between millennials and Generation X, or Generation X and baby boomers, or something like that. And if you
what are the changes in attitudes between those generations?
It's interesting. It all seemed to happen around the time that the smartphones took off and kids started going to high school, with a smartphone in their hand, and it all sort of became sort of networked. There's this huge increase in empathy. And also anxiety and mental health issues. But the best way to describe it, I think, is if you the film The Breakfast Club.
I do.
If you watch the Breakfast Club with Generation Z, it's fascinating because it makes no sense at all to them. No sense at all. To me, Generation X, we loved it. Millennials seem to quite like it. Generation Z, they start watching it. And for us, it was, these five kids and they have nothing in common, but they bond in opposition to this authority figure, Assistant Principal Vernon, who's the bad guy of the thing. First of all, they don't see the assistant principal as the bad guy because his motive is just, this is his job. He has to come into school.
Can I ask real quick? Sure. How do you know this? Is this like, did you do a focus group and watch Breakfast Club with Generation Z? Did somebody do an experiment?
I did watch Breakfast Club with Generation Z. And so this is a first-hand thing, but it does fit the sort of generational shifts that demographic researchers have been reporting. I'm not doing the difference between weather and climate thing here. I'm aware that I feel this is a valid example that sort of describes a more broader sort of shift. I put my hand on my heart and stand up with this sort of this analogy. it's not just a thing I saw once. They don't think the authority figure is the bad guy. He's just coming into work. He's just trying to make the school run better. He's not a nice guy. He's maybe comic relief at the best of it. For our generation, the hero was the Judd Nelson character, Bender, he was called. And he was a complete individual. He did everything by his own rules. He was unshakable from, what he wanted to do. And we were just in the 80s. We're like, he's really cool. He's totally doing it his own way. He's so cool. The Generation Z watch it and they just see a guy who's deliberately being cruel to people and go, oh, that's the bad guy, right? That's the bad guy. Judd Nelson is playing the bad guy. And then they see Brian character, the nerd character. And towards the end, he sort of confesses that he made a suicide attempt the previous week. And it's sort of played for laughs because he used a flare gun by mistake. And it's the sort of detail that my generation, we sort of forgot that. We didn't notice, we don't really think much about that when we see The Breakfast Club. But to them, clearly that's the emotional heart of the story. That's what matters. And so when the film ends with, Bender walking across the football field and he punches the air and Simple Minds blare out, the generation said, like, what the hell? That makes no sense at all. What sort of is this? There's been this real sort of shift in values. And the thing is, they're right. That's the annoying thing. They're absolutely right. You know, he was an arsehole. Molly Ringwald wrote an interesting thing about this in The New Yorker, about how there were scenes in some John Hughes films she did that seemed fine at the time. But looking back, there was one where that Bender character was hiding under the desk from the teacher, and she's a, you know, 16-year-old schoolgirl, and it sort of implied that he touches her inappropriately. And again, this seems sort of fine, and she's trying to get her head around, well, this is obviously wrong. Why didn't we see that at the time? You know, this generation immediately see that. They immediately see these things.
But some of this just seems to me to be generational change of mores. I mean, I almost want to back up here because I will admit that I'm more confused, not less now. The modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism. Like, how would you describe, like, what that trajectory is? I have some sense of it and I can try, but I think I'm going to get it wrong.
Okay, so backing up a little bit earlier, sort of leading into the sort of modernism period, the world was generally hierarchical. Things were sort of understood in their place, and it was the single vision of the person on top that structured the whole society, and it didn't really matter what you were like as a person. It was more what place you were in the hierarchy that sort of mattered. And I'm talking slightly more European here because, you know, going up to the First World War, this was still a world of emperors and czars and kaisers, and, you know, there was the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, German Empire, Chinese, British, Japanese empires. It was a world of empires. America is the exception here. But I mean, even so, you might argue that, you know, with the, I don't know, the annexation of the Philippines or the, you know, the separation of Panama from Colombia, there's reasons to say that. But culturally, you know, America was different. But for the rest of the world, the First World War was this point where, you know, the age of empires just ended. It just collapsed. It had been that way for all of history. And all of a sudden, it was over. I mean, the Japanese and the British empires lasted to the end of the Second World War. But generally, it was all sort of gone. And we came into this period where there wasn't this, you know, this one person at the top saying how things were. We came into this growth of individuals, which became many different perspectives. We started to see things from many different points of view. And modernism is trying to sort of find new ways of looking at things to shed new light on them, and also to try and reconcile all these, this clash of perspectives. So if you think of cubism, you know, you've got
postmodernism, you mean?
No, that's modernism, really.
Oh, this is still modernism.
Yeah,
okay,
that's modernism. It's trying to find new ways.
So modernism is what comes after the
hierarchical sort of world.
Okay,
and that's it was kind of seen as an elitist pursuit, but gradually it sort of filtered through into this sort of postmodern world. Now, I don't know how you want to describe postmodernism. It usually has many sort of a straw man sort of definition, where it means that, oh, nothing is true and, you know, everything is equal and all that sort of stuff. That's not a definition that, you know, any postmodernist would have gone through, but it is the recognition that, hey, that we've just got an awful lot of different perspectives that we can look at things through. And, you know, yeah, we have to sort of try and find a way to navigate throughout all these different competing views of the world. And there is no single truth in postmodernism. There is no one correct position, you know, from which everything else sort of makes sense. There is no hierarchy.
That reality is often constructed by these perspectives. That often what we think of as externally valid is in fact something that we have constructed through perspective consensus. But if you break that consensus, it turns out that often wasn't valid. And I'm not a postmodernist scholar, but that the places where there's a lot of controversy is where postmodernists take that and they say this infuses things you thought were solid. If I tell you that, you know, this social more is, you know, just we have decided, right? Like we have decided in America you don't burn flags, and that like other places might feel differently about that. You're like, okay, like that, I can grok that. And then if I tell you that science is socially constructed or certain parts of science are socially constructed, depending on what I mean by that, then people like really blanch.
Yeah, sure, I get that. Yeah, and it always has been that way. It was just, we were starting to realize it in the postmodern sort of, the postmodern period, we were starting to see those sort of problems with it and those flaws with it, I guess. I suspect you're trying to get to a point that I'm missing slightly with that.
No. I just wanted to, I am trying to connect what you were saying to the kind of caricature of it that I think the audience has heard the most.
Yeah. Okay. I think a postmodernist would say it's certainly just because there are many different perspectives on reality, that does not mean that there isn't, you know, a truth out there. It just means we're going to have to work an awful lot harder to have a valid understanding of what it is. I think that's probably the sort of postmodern worldview, to try and sort of sum it up in a way like that. But yeah, but we've sort of moved beyond it now to a period where it's sort of taken for granted that, sure, there's all these different models. We're not arguing about that anymore. We get that now. The question is, what works, right? What's useful? This is the sort of meta-modern sort of world that we're sort of going to. And this is the thing that sort of swings between these sort of extremes. So you can deal with both, you know, sincerity and sort of cynicism or irony or whatever. It's not choose a side and stick with it. It's you know, what tools are needed for what job. And so the question then becomes, well, what's important? What do we need to do? What's the work that needs to be done? What's our purpose? You know, what, how can we find sort of meaning? And then we'll use these models as best we can to sort of get there. And that's that sort of more active understanding is kind of how I see the difference between metamodernism and postmodernism. Metamodernism is right, we got the postmodern thing, we understand that sort of stuff, but we want to do this. How are we sort of going to? And you see it, I mean, climate strikes is a great example, with, you know, Greta Thunberg and all the sort of kids coming out around the world. I don't know how big that was in America, but over here it was just massive. And you know, we still had the climate change problem with the millennials, but they weren't doing things like that. They weren't getting up and doing things. And maybe a more accurate example would be the sort of the March for Their Lives with all the Parkland students. Because, you know, you had school shootings for the millennials, but they just sort of, you know, didn't think there was anything they could do. Once you get Generation Z, you know, then they organized, which I believe was the biggest political march in American history, and this huge sort of upsurge in activism and things like that. And obviously it's not ideal because it becomes politicized. So you get all these kids who've gone through a trauma who start to receive all this, you know, all this hate and attention, and you wouldn't want it any other way. But it's using what they had that would get some form of result. I think it's a real sort of shift. And again, the empathy, this extended circle of empathy that's come from this generation that have sort of, you know, grown up understanding themselves as part of networks. The 20th century was all about this growth in individualism, but it was sort of isolated individualism. With the Generation Z, with the meta-modern generation, they just understand that, you know, who they're connected to, what relationships they have, what their reputation is, are as much part of them, you know, as their physical body or the stuff that they own. If you see someone out taking a selfie of themselves, or maybe out in the street, you know, certain generations will go, oh, look at that person taking a picture of themselves to look at themselves. That's really vain. But younger people will say, oh, that person, they're taking a picture of themselves to include their friends in the moment, to share what they're doing, to sort of increase social bonds. And they don't see it that way. So that's a sort of there's been a shift in whether you view the world through the individual lens or through the sort of networked, you know, lens. And this is the generation sort of growing up now that understands that individualism doesn't describe anything. You know, it doesn't explain how things work, either biologically or sociologically or psychologically or emotionally or culturally. It's just too poor a model to use. So this moving beyond that into this sort of network group sort of understanding. This is probably in no way helping you get your head around metamodernism at all, is it?
No, well, I actually do find it useful. I mean, I'm speaking as an elder millennial, a little less, I think, optimistic. Well, optimistic is probably the right word, the wrong word, but I'm a little more worried about Generation Z. I don't see all of the trends as quite as positive, but I do think the overall thing you're saying tracks with what I've been seeing, which is this idea that we went from that we are watching a politics and a way of understanding the world move from a sort of modernist sense and a longstanding sense that there is a kind of objective truth out there in a lot of places, and move through the postmodernist period of really the project was about breaking down that truth. While to the point you make, people are actually postmodernists and think about it seriously, have a more nuanced view of this. I think the belief that the project of postmodernism was about introducing doubt, infusing institutions and infusing social mores with doubt and with suspicion. I think that's somewhat right. And I think something that you demonstrate very well in your books is the number of things that began to quake in the 20th century. I mean, I actually love the way you sort of use the example of physics here, of just in the 20th century, develop these competing physics models, all of which seem to be correct at some level and all of which contradict each other, and the people developing them don't even like them, right? Like the level of fury at quantum physics is, I mean, it's a fascinating and profound thing. And then the metamodernism seems a little bit more comfortable with this idea that, well, maybe nothing is going to be right, but that doesn't make it useless. This is a good time, if there's ever a good time, to take a break. So we'll be right back with John Higgs.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
I think there's actually a very nice bridge to your Timothy Leary biography, which gets at some of this stuff, I think, in interesting ways, particularly the way he moves through the psychedelic 60s into eventually this sort of networked model, right? He contains a lot in him. Why did you decide to write a biography of Leary?
Well, I mean, it just came about by circumstances, really. I was friends with an old British beat writer called Brian Barrett, who was just the most amazing man. Everyone who knew him just loved him to pieces. And he was very close with Timothy Leary for a period when, after Leary had escaped from jail and was on the run in Algiers and was with the Black Panthers, that's when Brian knew him. And then Leary had escaped from the Black Panthers, and so he was in Switzerland with his arms dealer, and Brian was there helping him write books at the time. Timothy Leary's life is just the most unbelievable string of outrageous sort of circumstances that you can imagine. It's I can't wait for someone to finally get that on film, because his life is quite something else. But as I say, my friend Brian was very close to Timothy Leary. Not so much in the 80s. Brian got very much into heroin, and Leary was having none of it. But he would, you know, he'd tell me all these stories about the things that they were doing. And whenever I heard Leary being mentioned, you know, in the media or something like that, I'd be always like, oh yeah, no, I don't think you've quite got the context right there. That's not quite how it was. And I was just thinking, God, someone really needs to write a book about Timothy Leary, because Rosemary Leary just died around that time. This was the early 2000s. And after thinking that for a year, it was just the dawning realization that, oh God, it's me, isn't it? It's me. I'm the one who's going to have to write this book. And I did. You know, I left a job and I went over to America to start researching it. And I wrote this book, I Have America Surrounded. And it was more... It was more because it presented itself as a thing that was necessary and sort of had to be done, that I'd sort of stumbled into more than anything else.
So I've always been fascinated by Leary, and I've read a couple biographies of Leary, and yours was the first one that I felt it saw the world from his perspective.
Yeah.
It was the first one that actually helped me understand the way he thought. And there was this quote you had that I'd not read anywhere else, And this is him talking after about the effect that his first major LSD trip had on him.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, afterwards, I've never been able to take myself, my mind, or the social world quite so seriously. Since that time, I've been acutely aware that everything I perceive, everything within and around me, is a creation of my own consciousness, and that everyone lives in a neural cocoon of private reality. From that day, I have never lost a sense that I am an actor, surrounded by characters, props, and sets for the drama being written in my own brain. And that just stopped me short. Sometimes if you read accounts of people taking psychedelics, you'll come across this exact feeling described as a kind of like a bad trip mental illness thing, that like they lose their sense of reality, that everything becomes actors on a stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you will see this. This is actually a common trope.
Sure.
And it is almost everywhere described as a terrifying thing that happens and takes people time to recover from.
Yeah.
And like what was so fascinating to me about your book is that Leary is somebody who has that experience, never recovers from it, but somehow is able to live within it as a kind of superpower, or like a demonic power. You can look at it both ways, but that was fascinating to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. No, he definitely got the joke. He got the cosmic joke. He saw, he was, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ideas that come from Leary that are really useful, that are really, the idea of reality tunnels we touched on earlier, which I should probably just briefly try to define. We all live in a reality tunnel, but your reality tunnel is not reality. It's what you think reality is. Okay, but it's just a model. But being a model, it's smaller and not 100% accurate, and there are places where it doesn't quite match the thing it's supposed to represent. But because we live inside the reality tunnel, we don't know where those bits are that it's not accurate. So we don't notice how our view of the world, how our worldview doesn't match the real world sort of exactly. And when we see, when something happens that entirely fits with our reality tunnel, you know, we accept it straight away. We don't question it. We just go, yep, that's fine. We'll suck it all down. And when something happens that contradicts it, it's like we deny it, basically. We just don't notice it. We just can't sort of see it. And there's various sort of psychological biases that sort of go into this, but they're very much being used politically, you know, these days. You know, if you're thinking sort of the Russians and the troll farms and all that sort of stuff, they will come up with untrue things that they know full well that, you know, such and such a political group will just accept without question, you know, because it matches perfectly what they're doing. And so being aware of that, of being aware of your reality tunnel, is the first step in sort of, you know, trying to be responsible for it and making it more accurate. You know, it's never going to be perfect, but you keep trying to fix flaws in it. It's a constant sort of doer upper and stuff like that. And that, I think, ties in with a lot of what you were saying, that notion. Does that all sound familiar to you?
Yeah, absolutely, very much. I mean, but this is one reason he's a fascinating character. I think most people who read about him in my generation, he's become a villain, right? Timothy
yeah.
Leary
oh, yeah,
is a
yeah,
guy
yeah, definitely,
who
definitely.
Took the psychedelic revolution, turned it into this kind of like countercultural monster, got the psychedelics rendered illegal, and so on and so forth. And I think there's some truth to that. There's also this other
I think there's
him.
Less truth to that.
talk through that, because I think that's actually how most people know him. And most of the books I had read about him largely buy into that theory.
Yeah, I mean, it's the notion that a lot of people in the psychedelic world have that, oh, if only Timothy Leary hadn't come along, then psychedelic research would be entirely, you know, respectable, and no one would have gone in any way strange, and we would all be sort of, you know, our families would all be delighted that we were so heavily into psychedelics and things like that. And it's just not the case, because, you know, psychedelics, they're just such a tricksy sort of thing. I mean, we were talking earlier about sort of ideas that have their own volition and their own sort of agency. If you wanted to say a drug like LSD was a sort of a living thing with a sort of a mind of its own, I think that's probably quite a strong case for that one. It is just a trickster. It's an absolute trickster chemical. So it was always going to be someone was going to, you know, it was always going to cause trouble, you know. And people use a lot of Leary's ideas without crediting him. Like, the most important part of, you know, psychedelic, first thing you need to know is set and setting, you know, that where you are, that your mindset is, what the the people around you are is going to have an effect on a drug. So on a psychedelic trip. So yeah, if you don't want a bad trip and you need to pay attention to set and setting. And it's things like that we get from Leary, that people who dismiss Leary will always, you know, they'll cling on to all his ideas and use them like that without sort of crediting it. Yeah. What I hope came across in the book was it was just all such a whirlwind, those years, those fast years. And it's very easy to sort of look back with hindsight and think, oh, well, yes, he should have done this differently there. But when you realise what the context of every decision was and all the pressures were and the, you know, all the changes that they were sort of going through, it's you know, no one was going to sort of walk that tightrope, you know, immaculately. And there's been when I haven't read the Robert Greenfield book, because when I was writing my book, I'd go and talk to a lot of people who Tim knew, and they would all say, oh yeah, this other guy, he came and interviewed us. He was writing a book, this Rolling Stone journalist, but he's stopped. He's given his advance back. He says he can't do it. And I go, oh, okay. And then when his book came out, he did go back to it and he did find a way. And his idea was, aha, okay, well, just make Leary the bad guy and that's my story. And all the people who I were talking to were just like furious because they'd spent a lot of time talking to this guy and sharing all their stories. And, you know, they'd known Leary for many, many years and they loved him dearly. And they'd say all these things that happened. And maybe on one occasion they had a fallout and it would just be that fallout that sort of made it into the book. So there was a lot of real anger. And the book that takes the view that, oh, he was the bad guy, has been very influential. And there's this notion with Leary that you get the Timothy Leary you deserve, you know, that comes down to all what we're talking about, this sort of all these different postmodern perspectives, that how you see him says as much about you as it does him. You could write a book where Timothy Leary was the hero, where you could write a book he was the villain, where he was a fool, where he was a clown. There's 100 different ways you could sort of interpret the things that happened. And it's, you have to take some responsibility for what you're projecting out onto what happened.
Yeah, and I think like with everything we've been talking about, it's important to be many modeled here. They're all true on some level. But I want to bring one more quote from your book real quick, because this seems to me to be the key around him and the key around what he represented, which is, and I think this is actually you speaking in the book, that Leary argued that it was crazy to live in a reality that was negative and unrewarding because there are an infinite number of other realities that the brain could use instead. This is the idea that underpins the majority of Leary's philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that turns people off of him and became the thing that turned many people off of the counterculture, right, in a bigger way and lost a lot of ideas that I think were important for a generation is, here's a guy, his first wife commits suicide while he is having an affair. His daughter later commits suicide. He ends up in jail. This like sort of string of wives who've been quite harmed by him. One Rosemary is on the run for, you know, most of her life from the law and so on. He does not have a great relationship with his son. And there's this way of looking at him that he takes a substance which is supposed to be ego dissolving, and he becomes this unbelievable ego monster who like runs through life causing wreckage of in the lives of the people closest to him, bopping into new realities, and then sort of towards the end says, like, nobody's ever been happier than me. And like, I think that's the part of Leary that people recoil from.
Yeah, yeah. But that's very early in, you know, that shift we were talking through this sort of postmodern world into this metamodern, you know, that's the sort of thing we're learning from now. You know, that he was very much a sort of pioneer in this new territory. And so we're learning where he went wrong on many levels and then trying not to do that ourselves, and which is all valid. It still doesn't take away from the things he did, the ideas that he expressed that are still useful to us. We still get a lot from what he did, but we can also learn from the, exactly those sort of mistakes. That whole ego thing in the psychedelic counterculture is, you know, exactly, I totally agree.
But that's actually the set and setting dimension. This is really interesting to me. So I'm fascinated by psychedelics and fascinated, I think, largely for the thing that's coming through in a bunch of your books. I'm fascinated that our sense of reality is so thin that a couple micrograms of a chemical can blow it to smithereens. Like, that's it. Like, it's gone. And the thing that I find interesting about him as a philosopher, as somebody who is thinking about these issues, is that that ends up being the core thing that he, like, that he gives to the culture. But then you get 50 years in the future, and here we are in a different set and setting, and psychedelics are making this interesting comeback, and I live in the Bay Area, which is ground zero for it. And it's become like the set and setting is productivity culture, right? You take psychedelics, you become more creative. There's this great Onion headline that I love. Ayahuasca shaman tired of helping people develop revelations about their SEO strategies. And so now you have it happening in this other context where the research is happening in a much more kind of like tight way, and people are being more careful with it. It's being sold on things like the Tim Ferriss show and Michael Pollan's new book and so on. My show is interested in it, right? I think it's all on some level for the good, but it's really interesting to see that in the set and setting that was happening around Leary, it's framed as this incredible threat to the society and culture, right? I have America surrounded. We're not going to fight in your wars or work for your corporations. And now it's like, you know what's going to help you work for our corporations and plan our wars? And it's the same chemical.
Yeah, but it's the same chemical in a different situation. If the situation is we're going to see how we can, you know, make money and be productive and be good worker ants and stuff like that, you know, whatever you put into that, that's going to be the way it reacted. Yeah.
And that idea of the set and setting, like it's so, like on a meta level, it's just so fascinating to see it working that way. I'm curious, as somebody who studied Leary and probably tracks at least some of the way this is changing, like, do you think he'd be horrified?
Oh, on many things, sure. Yeah. But I mean, he was, this is what people found tricky with him. He would just change to adapt to the situation he was in. So when he escaped from jail and was in Algiers with the Black Panthers, he sort of adapted to the Black Panthers and would talk about violence and guns and things in a way he never did before. Much horrifying the counterculture back in California. But when he got away from that and was with these... In Switzerland with these sort of, you know, rich arms dealers and things like that, he sort of started to dress very straight and you know, would drive a Porsche and drink champagne and just adapt to that sort of world. And when he was in jail, he sort of grew a mustache and became a bit like the guards, the FBI and the CIA sort of people, and he sort of became like that. It was like that Woody Allen film Zelig, where the guy just adapts to whatever situation he is in, and you have to wonder if there's a core to him somewhere that's still present throughout all these things. So I would imagine that if he was around today, he would still be doing that. Whether I'm saying he would be, you know, working for Trump, as I don't know if I'm going to go that far, but I'm just throwing that idea out there. Jesus, I don't know.
But the idea of him being fully absorbed by Silicon Valley culture actually makes sense, because towards the end of his life, he became a booster of early Silicon Valley culture.
Yeah. The PC is the LSD of the 90s, as he used to say. He was very much ahead of the curve at that thing. And it was at a time when, you know, computers were still viewed with distrust. I mean, why would anyone have a computer in their house? It just struck most people as absurd, and they were linked to, you know, pornography, and they were in, as always, these things they have a, when they're new, they have a slightly dodgy sort of reputation, and of course that side of him, everything he said has become so obvious that it's hardly sort of needs to be referred to now. He had this great book, Chaos and Cyberculture, in the very early 90s. He talks about when you're using a computer, your head goes through the Alice window. He'd call the computer the Alice window. You project your mind out there into cyberspace. And he was talking about the importance of balancing that out with, you know, in your physical body afterwards, like, you know, going for a run and playing sports and looking after yourself and all that sort of stuff, which is really far ahead of the curve, and, you know, absolutely dead right. Yeah, he was I mean, we all know Steve Jobs speaks so highly of the acid trip, and it's certainly no coincidence that Silicon Valley is where it is. I mean, it did emerge from the absolute, you know, heartland of the psychedelic counterculture. It sort of grew out that. And if you look at early online communities like the Well or sort of the crossover between universities and computers and the idea of home sort of computers and psychedelics, there's a really good book that looks at the connection between the psychedelic counterculture and Silicon Valley. And it's like the very first online sale, the very first online commerce was a drugs deal. You know, it's that sort of
I thought
level.
That was such a great detail. But let me offer a dark interpretation of that, which is much like happened with Leary himself and a lot of the counterculture, where you develop this technology, and psychedelics are a technology that is meant to dissolve your ego and throw you through the Alice window and let you connect to other people in a deeper way and be networked and be the us. And then it just becomes a bunch of people who seem to look after nothing but their own pleasure and become like deformed versions of themselves, at least in certain ways.
Especially in
the 70s and cocaine. The same thing happens here with these technologies that, you know, we were all going to like be thrown through the Alice window and be able to be in these communities of interest and disembodied. And, you know, nobody knows if you're a dog on the internet. And what do you get? You get these individual ego reinforcing, identity reinforcing machines where we're constantly curating this somewhat often monstrous version of ourselves for other people to consume, even as we become more withered here at the center of it. I mean, there's a way in which the analogy between what the promise of psychedelics was and what their effect was over time actually looks very close to some of the Silicon Valley products that they in some ways bolstered.
Yeah, definitely. And with these things, when they're sort of invented, they have these claims, these positive benefits that they will have. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for them and a lot of evangelical sort of championing of them. And then they get deployed and people use them and it spreads and people start finding the bad things that can be done. You know, companies use them for targeting individuals, or all the bad side of it starts to appear. And then there's always a danger of saying that, oh, these things, they're just bad. Well, but you've got to look at sort of both sides. You've got to look at all the good they're doing and the bad they're doing. This is what that metamodern sort of approach is. Previously, the idea, you go, oh, look, these things are flawed, they're bad, let's just get rid of them, let's just sort of go back to them. But in this idea where, you know, all models are flawed, but some are useful, it's important to understand how these things are used for bad, but it's also equally important to you to understand how they can be used for good and sort of have them as tools for that sort of thing, and not just dismiss the whole thing sort of outright, which is what we sort of tend to do as a journalistic sort of culture. Really, you come across as a lot more credible as a commentator or whatever if you just go, oh, there's this thing, yeah, it's bad. You know, if you'll be taken seriously, you know, you'll people will nod and scratch their chins and go, yes, it's important how bad these things, yes, very much. And that becomes the overwhelming sort of conversation. And the fact that the other side of them, you know, the things that are all the things they're enabling, all the things they're connecting, all the people they're sort of putting together, the people who are meeting the loves of their lives on the internet or whatever, or the people who are overcoming PTSD through psychedelic use and all that sort of thing, can get sort of swept away because I mean, a lot of this comes down to the algorithms of social media or the business models of our press and things like that just try and constantly, they just need our attention and they need to activate that lizard brain at the back of us. And so we get this constant sort of pressure just to see the bad side of it and be worried and be anxious and sort of be fearful. Blind optimism is no good, but a sort of pragmatic optimism where you sort of understand all the problems and you realize that, you know, that the optimistic mindset sort of, you know, finds dozens of possible solutions to a problem where the pessimistic just sort of gives up and does sort of nothing. Hopefully in this sort of more meta-modern world, that what's good about these things will be as used as much as the press just wants to talk about the bad things. We do need to understand the bad things properly to understand the whole thing.
Well, this seems like a modeling problem in general. I mean, I think if you're talking specifically about technology, for instance, the problem is not that the press is too negative now, though I think probably it is, and I am. But it was also that we were too positive before. It isn't that the only thing the press does is say it's bad. We said it was great, right? Everybody was a savior, right? For years, the technology press was, I would almost call it, like, not journalism at all. It was puffery, certainly a lot of it. It was evangelical. This is something that I think a lot about in my own work, but it is hard in writing to convey many modeledism. And I actually think that this is true for a lot of things. So I'm actually, right after I talk with you, I'm doing a podcast with Gia Tolentino, who's this great writer for The New Yorker. And I've been thinking a bit about her book, which is called Trick Mirror, which is very related to a lot of the things we're talking about, and related certainly in one of its early chapters to how the internet went dark. How did it become this thing that people feel so frustrated by? And one of the things I do believe is an answer is that a lot of the forms in which we operate on the internet, tweets or Facebook posts or columns, takes, they're like a first dimension of our feelings on something. And so we may be many modeled, but you can only have one model in a tweet. It's very hard to put multiple models in an op-ed. And so when you have a conversation with someone, as I often do with people on the internet who are more one-dimensional online, and we're having some kind of argument, and then we get into this space where we're talking, and it turns out we're multidimensional. And it is very just hard. And journalism is often written, or it is operating constrained spaces. If you don't have much time, well, here's my one model, the model I think you're most likely to connect to and is maybe the most useful at the moment. But the form I've become much more cognizant of destroys the ability or hinders the ability to be many modeled in a way that makes the entire enterprise a lot less truthful to the complexity of reality.
Which is why we just, you know, can't live by internet alone. You know, we have to sort of get away from our screens and meet each other in real world and communicate. You know, when you talk, if you're talking to someone and you just say a casually unthought out idea, and if it's awful, it doesn't matter in any way, shape, or form. You both understand the context. You know, it doesn't really matter. It's part of a larger conversation. But that one line if it was online, you know, could just produce the most anger and the most hate and the most thing. That's why the social media is brilliant for bringing like-minded people together. But they need to sort of then meet in the real world. You know, they need to sort of have actual, genuine sort of relationships that get across that sort of barrier, that single sort of meaning in a tweet and things like that. Again, that's that same thing about understanding what works and what doesn't, you know, and just going for what the most useful sort of tool is. And I find an awful lot of... whenever I go out and do talks around the country, which I often do, there's the amount of people who wanted to come together and do a thing. There's been this big sort of rise in the idea of arts labs. I don't know if you have arts labs in the US, but it's the idea of people just come together and they just make things and they just try everything, different things for the joy of it. I've seen a real sort of recognition that the internet alone is not enough. I don't know if you're seeing that over there in San Francisco,
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that maker culture, and whether it will scale to be an answer to what how much the internet is changing us, I don't know. But I do have a question on all this as we sort of move to wrap up here, which is, you've now spent, I guess, a decade or more thinking about the thinness of our connection to a singular reality, thinking about being many modeled, talking to people who were pioneers and all this. How has that affected how you move through the world? Like, how do you try to retain that openness and that multidimensionality?
Well, once you've taken the ideas on board, they're no more off-putting than any other ideas. I mean, I'm aware that in my books, and especially in the later books, what I try to do is I don't try and tell people what to think. I try and give them things to think about. I don't try and sort of force my truth onto people, because we've all got our own politics, we've all got our own views and stuff like that. But I'm always trying to give people like a situation, a perspective that they're so not used to, and that they have to then start to sort of question how things sort of fit together. And that's where a lot of the really lovely letters I get from my books come from, where people have just, I haven't sort of forced multiple perspectives on people. I've just given them ways to start to think about it, and when they sort of realize it themselves, it's living with this is easy, man. It's fine. It's not controversial once you've taken it on board.
It's not that the ideas are hard to take on board, but I maybe this is just me. I don't find living with it easy. I find that as I move through the world, and maybe this is partially my role as a political journalist, but the world constantly wants to like push you back, to make you defensive, to make you say, no, like this is right and you are wrong. Like I am declaring that this is wrong. And I mean, there's a lot of things in the world I do believe are wrong, right? There's a lot of feeling of a need to be on the right side of things, but also it's hard to remain open. It's like hard to remain fluid. I find it hard, even though it's something I think about a lot and work at a lot.
It's not impossible, though. I mean, I wrote a book a couple of books ago called Watling Street, which is about England and Wales in particular. And I wrote it around this time of Brexit. And obviously, you know, I've got my own views. You know, I didn't vote for any of that sort of stuff. You know, I really have no time at all for it. But I was able to write the book about, you know, geographic identity and things like that, with an understanding that half the people who read it would be, you know, pro-Brexit and leave, and half the people who read it, you know, would be Remainers like myself. And so, although the topic's in there, it is entirely possible to understand the multifaceted viewpoints of your readers when you're writing. At least that's what I certainly try to do. Anyway, I'm not perfect. Obviously, we make mistakes. And sometimes, for the sake of a good joke, you just want to sort of lash something out there. But recognizing that you're talking to all these different perspectives, once you've taken that on board, yeah, that's just what you do. That's just what the job is. That's just I wish more people did it, admittedly. It's always a real sort of disappointment when you have a hero or someone you've always liked, and then you just, and they get very tribal, and they, even when you agree with them, even when you totally agree with their politics, because you know exactly what they're going to say about everything, they're going to just turn up and go, oh, this thing, that's awful, blah, blah, blah. And you sort of know that already. You don't get the interesting, unexpected ideas that hopefully you get when someone is trying to write with an understanding of the plurality of the audience.
Or even of themselves. I mean, I think about this a lot, but this is my request to Silicon Valley. But you were talking about an answer to some of what's happening on the internet being these offline maker spaces. And I think that's true. I think a lot of offline things are a bit of an antidote. But given that we are going to have a digital commons, I think the question of how to help people expose their multidimensionality, expose their pieces of hesitancy, expose the many kinds of a thing that they are, as opposed to trying to get them to narrow into one thing that is easier to advertise to and easier to build a community around, I think that's going to be a real project. I think the great violence, or one of the great violences the internet does to us, is it shrinks us down. We didn't expect that, but it defines us by whatever interest we have connected into at that moment. And it makes it harder for us to be messy and complex, and then to see that messiness and complexity in others. Like we always sound more certain than we are. We always sound more singular than we are. And I think that it's going to be a project for a lot of people learning how to be human online. And that is not what a lot of the technologies that have been invented are trying to help us do.
Yeah, and it's very different for, like you and me, we're both writers. We're both public facing. We both have a sort of a public profile that we sort of need to sort of protect, and the desire to sort of make it a stronger brand to sort of, you know, help our careers and things like that is strong. Most people don't have that. Most people, they're connected to their mates, they're connected to their family. You know, they're not in no way public facing shape or form. They go about their jobs, you know, they meet their mates, they play football, all this sort of stuff. It's not so much a problem for a huge chunk of the internet users. You know, it's more for people in the media. Sure, totally, I totally get those problems, and they need to be thought about in great deal, but it's just us, you know. It's that sort of recognizing the different perspectives that other people have, and not just assuming that everyone thinks like you do.
I guess a good place to close out. So let me ask you what's always our final question, which is, what are three books you'd recommend to the audience that have influenced you that you think people should read?
Oh, three books that have influenced me. There's a book called The Patterning Instinct by a guy called Jeremy Lent, which is a book. It's a cognitive history of the world, really. It's a book about the history of ideas. I think that's an amazing piece of work. I can't recommend that enough. That's just wonderful. I would also suggest maybe Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson. We didn't really go down that route particularly, but because, oh man, there's a whole lot of things that are relevant with Wilson that would have fitted in with sort of modern sort of politics. But they have this notion, which they call Chapel Perilous, this place where all your maps have run out and you're just lost and you don't know how things are. And it's an absolute description of this sort of, you know, post-truth world we're sort of in now, except they've had that in the 1970s through psychedelics. And the way he finds a route out of it is, I think, really useful and still valid.
So if people are going to start somewhere with Robert Anton Wilson, it's The Cosmic Trigger for you?
Yeah, Cosmic Trigger 1 is probably a good bet, yeah. I mean, it's very mad. I mean, it's very 1970s counterculture, conspiracy, druggy. But enjoy that. Just enjoy it. Just go with it. You know, he's not asking you to believe anything. You know, his thing is, it's important not to believe your own BS, your own belief system, as much as it's important not to believe anyone else's. He has good things to say about doubt. He's an interesting guy, definitely. Yeah.
And then Alan Moore.
And then anything by Alan Moore. I'm tempted to say Jerusalem, but I know it's like a 600,000 words novel that would, modernist novel that would terrify most people. But let's say From Hell. Go from Hell.
John Higgs, thank you very much.
Lovely talking to you, Ezra. That was great. Thanks, mate.
Thank you to John Higgs for being here. I hope you all enjoyed that. I definitely did. Thank you to Cynthia Gill for engineering, to Rajay Karma for researching, and to Jeffrey Geld for producing. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production. And my email, as always, is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.